Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe. In the Greek myth, Narcissus became so absorbed with his own reflection to the point that he became his own world and everything else fell away. And that story is where we get the term narcissism. Anne Mann's book, The Life of I, The New Culture of Narcissism, discusses how narcissism has come to be part and parcel of everyday life and how this affects, even destroys, our relationships with others. Anne Mann is a prolific writer, a frequent contributor to The Monthly and The Australian. I spoke to her by phone from Melbourne. Anne, we're familiar with that cautionary myth of Narcissus, the guy who fell in love with his reflection. Does that ancient story have any bearing on the contemporary form of narcissism that you're talking about in The Life of I?
Well, yes. I think several paintings capture the meaning of narcissism. One of them is a wonderful painting by Caravaggio where Narcissus is leaning into a deep pool and gazing in a kind of addicted way at his own image. And all around him is darkness, everything else has fallen away. So he is not only addicted to his own image and he's not only in love with himself, but there is no other. There is no other person. There's no other life other than what he is looking at in the lily pond. So there's a sense of addiction there. There's a sense of obliteration of other people's interests pressing upon you. So, you know, that painting sort of captures it. And I think the ancient myth is slightly different, however, from contemporary sense of narcissism in that it's not only about self-love, it's about a deep sense of insecurity whereby the person is scrabbling always on kind of quicksand to project this image of themselves into the world. And we know that narcissism, from a lot of the psychological research, is a person, you know, a narcissist is a person who's got a really deep sense of superiority to others. And from that sense of superiority, a kind of grandiosity about themselves, a lot of rather unpleasant aspects follow. One of them is a sense of entitlement to be treated better than other people, and anger if they're not treated as they think they deserve. There's a willingness to exploit others and, you know, in the service of their pursuit of success or happiness. And there's a real lack of empathy, and it's probably the lack of empathy is the most important aspect of the narcissist's behaviour. But it's always this imbalance, you know, caught in that painting between the self and the other. There is not enough awareness that we, in the narcissist, that we live in a world bounded by other selves,
and
where they
have
their own subjectivity and their own needs.
You've argued that the narcissist is the character type for our time. So can you tell us what social, economic, cultural conditions need to be in place in order to produce that narcissistic individual?
Well, partly it's the rise of not just individualism, but what we might call selfish individualism or radical expressive individualism, where it's quite different from the classical idea of John Stuart Mill's, where you have your own individual views, but, you know, there are boundaries set by the rights of others so that you can't, in order to press your case, your life, your self-interest, whatever, forward, you can't actually violate the interests of another in doing so. And what we have instead is what Eric Hobsbawm called a boundless kind of libertarianism. Mm. And so the individualism is like a sort of a mutant virus. You know, it's taken on a whole different quality. But it's not just to do with individualism. It's also to do with a hyper-competitive and consumerist economy. So there's quite a lot of work, again, in empirical social psychology, looking at the effects of greater affluence, of greater competition, of the whole neoliberal leap forward into a free market economy where the muscular animal spirits of competition and drive and so on, ambition, are not to be bounded by the same preoccupations, for example, with inequality. So with the transformation of especially Anglo-American economies into a neoliberal form. There's quite different kind of a set of social relationships and a different kind of culture which goes with the new economy. And the new economy puts the economy first and foremost. As one person, Michael Sandel, said, you know, we used to have an economy and a society, and the economy was serving the society. Now we have an economy, and it's as if the society is serving the economy.
Lance Armstrong features in your book as a classic narcissistic personality. Now, it so happens that there's a new movie out which depicts the elaborate schemes set up by Armstrong and the rest of his team, which enabled him to dope and yet also maintain this squeaky clean image at the same time. That film is The Program.
What does it take for you to race?
I just love to ride my bike.
Why are you so obsessed with this?
Why are you not obsessed with this?
He wins and wins and he celebrates, he meets the president, he gets more sponsors, more money, more fame. The man is a cheat.
I am the most tested athlete on the face of the planet. I have never tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs.
He is transforming your little Eurosport into a globally significant brand.
If he's cheating in the races, then he's cheating on us as well.
I will not be brought down.
We're all on the program.
I didn't sign up for this.
He will attack anyone who steps out of line.
I have the money and the power to destroy you.
That's the trailer for The Program. And people have been enthralled by the lies of Lance Armstrong and his spectacular fall from grace. What can he teach us about the culture of narcissism?
The chapter that I talk about, Lance Armstrong's called It's Not About the Bike. And it's called that because I wanted to show that actually many of the values of the outside culture of, you know, whatever it takes and that success is everything and achievement is everything, were actually penetrating this wonderful race, but also sport. And so that corruption then I could see was, you know, was a part of this neoliberal society where the culture, you know, became whatever it takes. And so there was this, you know, lethal kind of competitiveness. And, you know, the essence of sport is that we see these remarkable human feats, but it is always bound by rules, you know, by, and it is only worth something if it is not to do with cheating. So, you know, this really deep and profound corruption seemed to me to be a kind of, the Tour de France was a metaphor for what was happening in the larger society.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith. My guest is Anne Mann, author of The Life of I, The New Culture of Narcissism. And you've mentioned the rise of the market society and its role in encouraging narcissism. What about, in addition to that, the falling away of traditional sources of authority, like religion? Religions have lots of prohibitions against greed and selfishness.
Well, I think there's something in that. I'm not a religious person. However, I, seeing the matter culturally, I think that, and notwithstanding some greedy behaviour on behalf of some of the churches, you know, institutions, nonetheless, some of the teachings of Christianity, let's say, definitely are great warnings against the corruptions of greed. I was really taken with one researcher called Paul Piff, who has done in the US a lot of studies of a very both simple but arresting kind on the nature of the effect of wealth on people. And he found that the more affluent the person was, the more likely they were to do things like not get by at crossings if they were in a later model and much more expensive car. They were not much less, you know, four times less likely actually to give way in a motor car, and again, three times less likely to give way to a pedestrian. And then he went and looked at all these other cases where, in the laboratory, where he found that they would draw larger circles for themselves if they were wealthy, and that they were less willing to give to charity. And he found this also mapped across the actual society, so that people who were in the top income group were less likely to give a large, you know, didn't give a bigger percentage of their income to charity as those on a much lower income. So coming back to your question, you know, that in terms of Christianity, there are all kinds of messages which were against greed, you know, the idea of it being harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to go to heaven. There are many, many sayings which remind, but also much of the thrust of the teachings of Jesus Christ were against the maximisation of privilege and for a radical egalitarianism.
If people like yourself who no longer look to religion or don't look at religion to provide that sort of, I guess, restraint against human impulses like selfishness, then what other resources might you, for example, look to in order to help, you know, be that kind of person who is empathic, who is other person-centred, etc.?
Well, I think that the way we raise children has a lot to do with it. I talk in my book about the roots of empathy, and we do know that some ways of raising children tend to promote moral development, and one of those, you know, one of the really key aspects is having secure attachment with your parents, which is not really all that difficult to do. It just, you know, it does require some time, and it requires love, and it requires understanding, and it requires, in many cases, you know, being raised in thoughtful and sensitive ways yourself. So it's much harder for someone who's had an incredibly rough time as a child and has an insecure attachment to their own parents to be able to parent their children. In terms of religion, I still think it's, I wouldn't, even though I'm not a believer, I actually still think that religions have a lot to offer in terms of the ethical framework, whereby they, you know, the sense of how to live is bounded by not only what is good for the self, but what is good for others. And I think perhaps one of the greatest transformations, along with that rise of the selfish individualism I was talking about, and this, you know, hyper-competitive, anything, you know, whatever it takes kind of economy, is a change from seeing one's life under the eye of God to seeing one's life under the eye of one's peers. So that the way we monitor ourselves in the world is through likes on Facebook or the number of followers on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. So that, you know, supposing you're a carer of someone with a disability, supposing you're a carer with someone with a mental illness, supposing you're not living a glittering career life.
The Facebook-worthy life, yeah.
Supposing you don't have a lot of money. You know, all of these, you know, we once had a source of nourishment for such a life, and that nourishment came from the idea of the good. So I do think we need to, as many people, you know, are not believers, we need to somehow rethink what it is to live a life, how to live, and to live it in the light of the good, not just to live it in the life of what is good for the self.
What can hold back the narcissistic tide?
There is a way in which we need political leadership to arouse our empathy, a leadership that is able to cut through the kind of narcissism on offer, stop using it as a part of politics, because often there is a dog whistling of narcissism in our federal politics, making people feel aggrieved that there's someone out there who's got it easier than they have, some welfare cheat, some, you know, someone else is doing it easy, whereas they are doing it tough. And that all of that language is conjuring resentment in people. It's drawing it out rather than saying, look, you know, we're an extremely wealthy society and we can afford this. We can actually contribute generously to foreign aid, or we can treat refugees in the following way. So that a lot of the behaviour of politicians has started to reflect the narcissism in the society at large, and actually both manipulating it and taking advantage from it. So those people who are tending towards behaving in a more narcissistic way can be guided either towards selfish behaviour, or alternatively they can be led towards more altruistic and empathetic behaviour.
Thank you so much for talking with us, Anne. Your book, The Life of I, is very sobering and quite depressing, but it's good to know that you have some hope for us yet.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. For more on this topic and many more besides, go to publicchristianity.org.